This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkur, and more importantly, today I have the pleasure of welcoming to the podcast Dr. Michael Stausberg, who is a professor of religion at the University of Bergen in Norway. He is the editor of a really fascinating collection of studies called Religions, Mumbai Style, Events, Media, Spaces. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to your wonderful podcast that I enjoy very much listening to myself. And by the way, apologies to all listeners for my horrible accent and my imperfect English. Please bear with me.
Well, I'm sure they've long forgiven me for my impoverished Canadian accent. So everyone has an accent relative to somewhere else. You know, I might switch enough. I'll switch to Indian English halfway through, I'm sure. but thank you for expressing your appreciation for the podcast. You know, now I'm well aware, I can infer that the podcast is its own thing. It's a thing, it's a force. But really, for years, I'd be talking into a black box with a lovely interlocutor like yourself in the middle of, you know, research, clients, what have you. And you really don't have a sense of the audience, because you're speaking to one person and only one person, right, and then it goes off, and then they edit it, they send it out. And but I do get the random comment from you now. And nowadays, when I invite people, they more than often than not say, "Oh, I listened to the podcast. I know the podcast." So it's reassuring. There's hope. That's great. How did you get interested in Mumbai? How did this start? This fascination with this city.
Yeah, that's a good question, and my angle is more through the back entrance, as it were. As a student in the history of religions, I studied Zoroastrianism, and I was learning Avestan and Pahlavi, and I got interested in who are these people practicing this religion today, and where are the manuscripts of these texts kept? So I started to plan a journey, a trip to Mumbai to actually study Zoroastrianism. And through Zoroastrianism, I started to get fascinated by the Parsis as a religious or ethnic religious community. And then from the Parsis, Mumbai opened, or Bombay, as it was still called during my first visit, opened its gates to my brain. That's how my fascination with Bombay or Mumbai started. So through Parsi glasses, as it were.
Yeah. And so what would you say, let me ask you this way. What was the genesis of this particular book project? How did this come into being? What's the backstory for the book itself?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of backstories. I guess that's always the case. And the first one was this kind of enlarging my horizon when studying the Parsi community. People were telling me about this or that space or this and that event. And slowly, slowly, I ventured out and got fascinated by this, by the religious landscapes surrounding the Parsi community. And then eventually, a kind of shift in perspective happened. While I first looked at Mumbai or Bombay through Parsi glasses, later on the city itself became more foregrounded. I started to conceive a project on religion in Mumbai around 10 years after my first visit and after I had published volumes about Zoroastrianism. Then I got a job here in Bergen, and that project did not materialize because I moved over here and had other projects to pursue. And then at a conference about Judaisms in Asia, where I gave a talk about the Bene Israel, I ran into a colleague who was also presenting there and who is one of the contributors to this volume, started to revive this idea. So the two of us started to consider whether we could do something together. And then a new person entered the scene, my colleague István Keul here in Bergen, and we were so fortunate to get a grant from the Norwegian Research Council that allowed us to travel to Mumbai and to recruit two PhD students, and that is how the project then got alive. But from there onwards, again, it took a couple of years for this eventual outcome to materialize.
What are some of, and certainly it goes without saying that Mumbai is a fascinating and rich and very important global city, but, you know, just to follow suit from my purposely naive shtick, you know, what are some of the defining distinctive features of Mumbai? What warrants a book on the religiosity therein? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. I think it's all about contrasts and paradoxes, if you want. So Mumbai is really not known as a city that has a religion high up on the agenda. It's mainly known as the business capital, as the media capital, as the financial capital, etc. And so in a way, it for a long time seemed like a stereotypical modern city. And in modern cities, religion wasn't really that important. But then suddenly, for example, in 92, the riots happened. And when you look back into history, you find a long series of interreligious clashes that played out in the city. So that is one paradox, the kind of the secular religious paradox. Another one is the paradox of the of a cosmopolitan self-image that Mumbai or Bombay has projected about itself for a long time, and this history of these clashes, rivalry, competition, violence that was often defined or acted out along religious or religious communal boundaries. So it's this paradoxality, this quality of contradictions that fascinates me about Bombay as a city, but also in relation to religion.
Why is the subtitle Events, Media, Spaces?
Yeah, thank you. A great question. And this is actually a result of our methodological choices. When you study such a complex entity as Mumbai, how do you in terms of religion or its religious history or landscape, how do you approach such an entity? I think a traditional approach, and one that is very much practiced by Indian scholars on the ground, is to do a series of portrayals of communities. So you would have a chapter on various Hindu groups, of various Muslim groups, of minorities like the already mentioned Parsis or Bene Israel, or the Jains, the Sikhs, the Christians, etc., etc. But instead, we decided that we wanted to study religions in interaction with the city and in interaction with each other. So that's why our initial focus in the research project was actually on spaces and places, and that would include things like religious neighborhoods, religious so-called ghettos, small roadside shrines, as an example, for the road as a religious space. That would include religious sanctuaries or sacred spaces that attract people from different religious groups. But that would also include, for example, courts as places where religious identities are being negotiated, and also, in my case, taxis. So we initially had this focus on spaces as an organizing methodological point of entry into the city, and then we extended this into also covering events and media. And if you want me to elaborate on this a little bit, then this would go roughly as follows, that spaces are often transformed in events, like, for example, in festivities or large-scale celebrations, like the iconic Ganpati Utsav in Mumbai, or like the Muharram, where celebrations and festivities transform the spatial setup of the city for a certain amount of time. And on the other hand, we realized, of course, that when you study a city, then the self-perception in media is always already a part of that. So the city doesn't exist as such, but it only exists via its representations, the images that are being projected about it and about its residents, about its citizens, about what happens in a city. And these representations are to be found in media. This triangle of spaces, events, and media is in a way not as arbitrary as it might first seem when you see it on the cover of the book, but it's kind of a logic of what you see in research on the ground.
Yeah, and I think perhaps one of the most iconic analogs, sort of high-profile analogs, at least in North America, would be New York City. And think of the experiences that people have of the texture of New York City and its various neighborhoods through decades of you name it, sitcoms, crime shows, you name it. And so I think people might get a clearer sense of the relationship of the way in which your experience of New York City is already crafted before you even arrive by virtue of all that's been curated and presented and represented about it. And so,
absolutely,
So then, so what are some of the subfields or disciplines or fields of inquiry that this volume implicates, you think?
Are you addressing which kind of scholarship is being?
Yeah, I would say, for lack of a better word, you know, what disciplines? I mean, certainly religious studies without question. There's also sort of people interested in the study of space. I mean, you know, what interests or disciplines does this book cater to, do you think?
Yeah, right. The eventual group of contributors to the volume, which is larger than those immediately involved or more directly involved in our project, covers a range of disciplines. And I would like to mention the important contribution by social anthropologists also sociologists to the book also legal anthropologists, for example, people also having a background in social work. This is one of the nice things when you work together with a theme, or in this case, a field in a very concrete sense that fascinate you, then these interdisciplinary boundaries more often than not are enriching rather than a delimiting factor.
Yeah, indeed, it is fascinating. Would you say that this sort of approach of taking a deep dive into a particular city and the multivalent nature of that city, would you say that this is relatively atypical? Is this a burgeoning field? Has this been done with other Indic cities? Is this fairly novel?
I think it has not been done with other Indic cities. There is a beautiful book by Daniel Gold called Provincial Hinduism on Gwalior as kind of a middle-sized city, but his focus is, though there is a chapter on Sufi shrines, it's mainly about Hinduism in this city, which of course you could not do in the same way in a book on Mumbai, but that is a monograph, and I think our volume is, as far as I know, the first that tries this kind of methodological setup on an Indic city.
Excellent, because that was also my own impression, but you certainly would know. You would know better having researched in this field. So while you were this journey of editing these papers, you know, it just so happens that a volume of my own and a co-editor, McComas Taylor, just came out today in real time. And
congratulations.
Thank you. But it's more to say, you know, I can both I can share in perhaps a bit of the experience of having, you know, a number of really rich, brilliant, fascinating papers come together where you look at them individually, and then you get to take a step back as the editor and think about the whole, right? Think about the forest versus the trees, think about how they come together and sort of themes across. So open-ended question, are there particular findings that surprised you or that were literally remarkable? Were there particular areas of investigation that sort of really stood out to you? Were there particular through lines across the papers that sort of stand out to you, having sort of edited them? What would you say?
Well, this is a little of a tricky question, as kind of as it pertains to, let's call it, editorial ethics, in the sense that I think all editors have their kind of favorite chapters, chapters that sort of came with some kind of an aha experience that really surprised you. But then I would hesitate to single out single chapters because I would feel I'm doing injustice to the other fine papers that there are. And then in an editorial process, you also experience that there are some chapters where you work with the authors for a couple of years, and some chapters or texts or authors are more resistant to editorial requests or interventions, maybe for the better good, and others are more of a shared product than what is maybe apparent from the names given on the title page, and then there are others that come relatively late in the game and that you sort of hadn't really expected. So it's, I think, always a little a basket full of surprises. And now with the core group of colleagues that were involved in the project that I mentioned before, there were kind of processes of mutual impact and resonances that had been going on during our workshops, that are kind of, in retrospect, maybe a little difficult to disentangle. Now, this is very much kind of on the surface level of collaboration. So I'm a little hesitant to say all our listeners must read these three chapters because they are the most brilliant of the lot. However, when I edited this book, I mean, what you see is all that which is missing. Especially in a topic or a city that is so rich, so in some cases or in many cases, it's basically impossible to find scholars who did study this or did study something in Mumbai that has been studied, say, in Delhi or Karachi or Chennai, and other scholars whom you would like to see involved show you a cold shoulder because they, in the meanwhile, have passed over to other projects or because they are advised not to publish in edited volumes, but to focus on journals only to enhance their promotion or recruitment prospects. As an editor, then you kind of are faced with a situation where you feel that there are many bricks in the puzzle that you would have liked to add to make it more complete, to give an even richer picture. But that doesn't really work. And this is why I did the relatively unusual step, I'd say, to write a very long introductory chapter, which is, I think, of around 60 pages, but where I tried to kind of weave a tapestry of the city in a more systematic manner, and also in a manner that gives more of a historical background to the book, which is very much focusing on the present. So this is a little unusual, maybe, but this is caused by my desire to make the book appear less fragmentary, as is in the nature of edited volumes like this one. And then there is one further aspect, and that is the time gap. So, as already mentioned, I kind of started mentally preparing for this volume around 30 years ago, and then it slowly took shape, and I basically submitted the manuscript to the publisher a couple of months after COVID had hit us. This, of course, is kind of a speed aging for this kind of book, because it seemed to have written or have been written or drafted, composed, researched in a prehistorical age, because COVID is something like a wall in the middle of the room that somehow separates us from things that happened only a couple of years ago. And it's really for this kind of a project also almost tragic that the nature of the pandemic also made it virtually impossible to study it on the ground, and to thereby also provide a further layer of reflection on the different chapters.
Yeah, COVID is sort of like I think of it as the flood before the flood.
Exactly.
Anti-Sloofian exactly. Times. Yeah. I love the texture with which you answered the last question, the reflection. Thank goodness I was muted, as is my custom when my guest is speaking. Otherwise, there would have to be a lot of editing out of my laughing out loud at so many of the so much of what you say is familiar. You've presented a wonderful picture of the texture and the scenarios involved in this process without, of course, naming names. And of course, I would never ask you to tell me who your favorite children are or which ones are smarter than the other ones, although they may already know that, but we don't say these things out loud. But thank you for responding to that in a way that I think offers insight into the process. Perhaps last question I'll ask you today is in terms of, first of all, feel free to share anything else about the volume that you hope we touch on. But also, I'm curious to know whether you're still working along these lines. Is there, you have diverse and fascinating research interests, pertaining to Mumbai and beyond. you know, what next? What now? What's next on your list of things to work on?
Yeah, right. Yes, I would actually like to go back and see the city in the light of the book. As we've been talking about the amount of time it has taken for the book to be published after being submitted, which basically had to do with that Oxford University Press didn't find a second reviewer. So we've been waiting for almost 2 years to actually get 2 reports on the table. This is another matter. But now, given that so much time has passed and that the flood had come in between, it would really be interesting for me to see whether my perspective on the city has changed as a result of working on this book, and to what extent the city has changed also as a result of the pandemic. But this is not something that I have on my agenda right now. What takes much of my time, my research time at present, is a project that, however, again, has to do with my exposure to Bombay, namely religious minorities. So when I first came to Bombay, as I told you earlier, it was to study the Parsi communities, and then I discovered all these other minorities in Bombay that had been so incredibly important as ferments of the emergence of this metropolis, that the religious minorities has kind of been into my research genes ever since that first visit. And now we are editing, that is, I am co-editing with my colleague Alexander van der Haven here in Bergen and Erica Baffelli in Manchester, a work called Religious Minorities Online, which is a handbook of religious minorities research organized alongside portrayals of communities, portrayals of countries, and systematic topics in the study of religious minorities. And that is available open access. And the first bunch of articles have come out in July. And the next update with another upload of 6 or 8 chapters will be out in January. And we'll envision this project to go on for another 3 or 4 years, and thereby providing something like what we imagine to be the main reference point for the study of religious minorities, which in a way is a very kind of evident and taken for granted thing. I mean, we all have an idea on what a religious minority is, and we all sort of see religious minorities at most places where we are, or issues surrounding religious minorities. But there is surprisingly little coherent research on this theme. This is what we are trying to build on in this project, for which I have, for example, just finished an entry on discrimination against religious minorities, but also discrimination among and within religious minorities. So this is coming up in the next upload. In addition to this, I am working on a revised edition of a book that I published a while ago called Contemporary Theories of Religion that came out in 2009. And now it seems time to do an update since several new theories have come up since 2009, which will be discussed in this volume. So maybe if I come to see this age, maybe in 15 years, I'll do a religions Mumbai style revisited.
That sounds like you have no shortage of interests and projects on the go. Let's definitely have you back in the not too distant future to talk about the next set of uploads on your study of minorities, etc. I think that would be fascinating for our listeners to learn more about.
That would be great.
So yes, you're certainly welcome back. We'll chat briefly after we close here to set that up. But thank you for appearing today.
Well, thank you for your interesting questions.
They're naive questions. I sometimes I wonder if the audience thinks I'm a blithering idiot, but maybe not. We'll see. But for those listening, we have been speaking with Professor Michael Stausberg on a fascinating collection of studies called Religions Mumbai Style. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, keep thinking, and keep contemplating the textured nature of the city in which you live. Take care.